Welcome to the Pethul Project, a podcast that explores the library of scripture, person of Jesus, and how they apply to our lives. On January 11th, the United States and the United Kingdom conducted joint airstrikes that targeted Houthi military facilities. In this episode, we speak with my good friend Sameh, who, in my opinion, is an expert on the Houthis. He's a graduate from the American University of Cairo and has joined there as faculty. He also has been specifically interested in Yemen and the Houthis for nearly a decade. The episode is quite long and quite detailed, but nonetheless, I hope that you find its analysis insightful and helpful for how we as Christians can conduct ourselves moving forward. Welcome to the Pethul Project. I'm joined here today by my friend Sameh, who is a graduate from the American University of Cairo and also a teaching fellow who has worked there and has lived in the Arab world for many years and has been interested in the Houthis and Yemen for even longer. And I think that he has some very insightful knowledge and perspectives on the Houthis, the Yemenis, and the situation more broadly as it's unfolding in the Middle East. So we want to get into this conversation and ask him some thoughts and some origins. And hopefully this will be helpful for us as we try and understand what's happening in the Middle East. So on January 12th, the US-based think tank, the Institute for the Study of War, released a briefing, you could call it, where they said the United States and the United Kingdom conducted joint strikes on January 11th that targeted Houthi military facilities to degrade the group's capability to attack ships transiting the Red Sea. The U.S. aircraft surface and subsurface vessels launched over 100 precision-guided munitions that targeted more than 60 Houthi command and control munition depots, production facilities, air defense, radar systems, and drone and missile launching systems in 16 locations across Yemen. The UK Defense Ministry reported that 4 RAF Typhoons used precision-guided bombs to target Houthi drone and cruise missiles launching positions in northwest Yemen. The Houthi military spokesperson Yahya Sari says that US and UK forces carried out 73 raids across Yemen, which killed 5 Houthi fighters and wounded 6 more. The UK Defense Ministry reported that the Houthis' ability to threaten international shipping, quote, has taken a blow, end quote. So if we were to ask why the Houthis have attacked the Red Sea, if you've been following the conflict in Israel and Gaza, this won't be news to you, but just to quote from a BBC article that was published on January 11th, they said the attacks began after the start of the Israel-Hamas war on October 7th. The Houthis declared their support for Hamas and said they would target any ship traveling to Israel. It is not clear that all of the ships attacked were actually heading there. In November, they seized what they said was an Israeli cargo ship. They since have attacked several commercial vessels with drones and ballistic missiles. The Houthi attacks in the Red Sea have increased 500% between November and December. The threat has been so great that major shipping companies have ceased sailing in the region and insurance costs have risen tenfold since early December. Major shipping firms, including the Mediterranean shipping company Maersk, Hapag-Lloyd, and oil company British Petroleum have all said they are diverting vessels from the Red Sea, end quote. So there's some serious developments happening in the Red Sea, Yemen, Israel, and Gaza. Sameh, I'm curious, first of all, who are the Houthis? And from an ideological perspective, the conflict with Saudi, where have they come from? Who are they? Can you tell us a little bit more about the Houthis?
Yeah, the Houthis are... Yemen is a country that's been pretty divided in terms of civil war and factions for a long time. And it's always been divided religiously. It's always had, pardon me, the north has been primarily Shiite and the south primarily Sunni. So the north is Shia of a sect called Zayidi, which is a very moderate form of Shiism from the perspective of what the normal differences between Shia and Sunni are. But they are different from Sunni, and I suppose any difference is enough to divide.
So what would be the main difference between the Sunni and Shia divide within Yemen?
Within Yemen, I don't want to overspeak and make it seem more religious than it actually is, but the main difference that Sunni and Shia have, if you were to put it in a nutshell, is that Shia think that the Prophet's nephew Ali ibn Abu Talib should have been the successor instead of his best friend Abu Bakr as-Siddiq. And so that is the difference between the Zayidis in the north and the Sunnah in the south. And as far as theology goes, the reason that that matters is because a lot of what constitutes Sunnah belief and Sharia law comes from the Hadith, which were collected by the Prophet's companions. And a lot of the narratives about the Prophet's companions become important also for fiqh, for determining Islamic jurisprudence. So as a
Okay.
result of that divide, the Shia have different hadith. So we
Okay,
would
that's
what
helpful.
when you normally talk about Sunni Islam and you Islam, sorry, that my accent today. When you normally talk about Sunni Islam and you want to assess what they believe about certain things, you quote Sahih Bukhari, and you quote the six canonical hadith collections, or the six recognized hadith collections, and you usually focus on two, Muslim and Bukhari. You can't do that with Shiism because they have different books. So, and they have different books because they venerate different people. And so the people who were instrumental, some of the folks who were instrumental in the hadith narrations and passing on the traditions that make up al-Bukhari and make up Muslim, are not nearly as venerated by Shia. Chief among them, the Prophet's youngest wife, Aisha, was famous to most people because she was 6 years old at the time of her marriage to the Prophet. And she went to war with Ali ibn Abu Talib. So she went to war with Imam Ali, which is highly venerated by the Shia. So they don't respect her the same way that Sunni do, and she is instrumental. She's collected and passed down a lot of traditions that make up the Sunnah, as Sunnis understand it. The Hadith would be a very different picture, and the knowledge of the Prophet, the biography of the Prophet, as far as Sunni are concerned, would be very different if it weren't for Aisha and the traditions she passed down. And Sunni don't respect Aisha a whole lot
So then would
because they don't
this
respect her father, Abu Bakr.
okay.
She's
So
the daughter of Abu Bakr.
would this because Saudi is predominantly Sunni,
Yeah.
would this then be feeding into the conflict with Saudi and Yemen and the Houthis? How does that work in
Yeah,
regards
I
to the
would say that
conflict
it
there?
does, but I would, and I don't like to be very reductionist in political analysis. Maybe we'll get to talk about that later, but a lot of people reduce complicated ideological disagreements to land and power and all kinds of concrete things. I don't like to be like that, but I would probably side on that side, if that's not redundant, in this conflict. So the Houthis are Shia, and there are a particular brand of Shia that isn't as wild and out there as Iran. But it's enough of an in for Iran to have made them an ally in Yemen. And for Saudi Arabia, the Saudis, to make the southern government and the southern government and the southern army their allies, because the south is Sunni and the north is Shia. So Iran has been supporting the Shia in the north, and Saudi Arabia has been supporting the Sunni in the south. I wouldn't reduce all of that to religion, because as we know, Iran also supports Hamas, which are Sunni. So it's not an absolute rule that Iran's going to side with the Shia and Saudi Arabia is going to side with the Sunni, but it is, if you can say, a way of getting your foot in the door in a country for Iran if there's a Shia minority. When Saudi Arabia was formed, it was formed by a partnership between the first Saudi king, Malik ibn Saud. The reason it's called Saudi Arabia is because that's the name of the royal family. Arabia just means Arabia. And a man by the name of Abdul Wahhab, who's a founder of his namesake, is the school of thought, al-Wahhabiyya, the Wahhabis. And they carried out a lot of, to use the word, acts of genocide against the Shiite minorities in Saudi Arabia. And we all know that Saudi Arabia's very often want to persecute Shia clerics and persecute Shiites in Saudi Arabia. So do I think the conflict is... and provides for the siding and the alignments that have developed.
Sorry, Stephen, it just cut out there for a second. You said, do you think that the conflict, I missed it.
I don't think it's religious, but I think that the similarities in religion do play a factor in who picks which side. I think Saudi Arabia and Iran are always vying for power in the Middle East, with Saudi Arabia winning most of the time. And Iran is always looking for ways to exert influence. And a Shiite minority at Saudi Arabia's bad track record with Shiites isn't in. It's a way of getting people to align with you, even though you don't have the resources that Saudi Arabia has and you don't have the weapons. And once you align yourself with Iran, you become kind of a pariah as far as Western countries are concerned, of course, and you'll get on the terrorist list pretty quickly. And so you lose out a lot, probably by siding with Iran since the collapse of the Soviet Union. There was a time when the Soviet Union had their team and the United States had theirs. There was a bit more of a parity between the two sides. I think when the Soviet Union rather dissolved, it became a lot harder for nations to resist American influence, of course. Mm-hmm. So because there just wasn't an option. But now that BRICS has arrived, there's an option again. Now that BRICS has arrived, for a lot of folks who are hostile towards the United States, and we'll talk about this in a second, but the Houthis are very hostile towards the United States, towards Israel, or for any other reason, just don't want to have a lot of Western influence on their country, BRICS is a nice alternative, perhaps a new Soviet Union, if you will, for people to another source of resources to keep anti-American allies in the Middle East functioning.
Yeah. And I
so
think
the Houthis... Yeah, go ahead.
Was it last week that Saudi joined BRICS, which obviously the I in there is Iran, and they've been increasingly normalizing relations, Saudi and Iran.
So
what, maybe we can get to this in a bit, but I'm curious how then that alliance between Iran and Saudi is going to work if the U.S. is going to continue to press the Houthis. What's going to happen?
Yeah.
Because I think this is just the beginning. I don't think that this is going to de-escalate anytime soon.
Right. Well, you did ask me a question that I haven't answered yet. The Houthis were founded in 1994 by a man whose name was Houthi. Their name doesn't mean anything. The founder of the organization was a man named Hassan Houthi, and his brother, Abdul Malik Houthi, is now the leader of the organization. It's not like Taliban, which... or ISIS, which all have symbolic meaning. And basically, I don't know if they've ever called for the independence of northern Yemen, but they've certainly declared war on the south and tried to exert influence on the south. And then the big important thing that happened, and this was important for everyone who knows a thing about Yemen. I wanted to go to Yemen for the very first time in 2013. And I couldn't go because this happened. I wanted to go and study Arabic. The Houthis were fighting a civil war with the government in the south, and up until this stuff that's happening now, they were definitely winning. And so they conquered the capital. They took the capital in 2013. The capital, Sana'a, is now controlled by the Houthis. And all of the political elites had to flee, and they now live in Saudi Arabia. And the former president, Abdel Hadi Man Abdurab, I don't remember his name exactly. He was executed and dragged through the streets. So they were actually really a strong force in Yemen and winning the war and exerting a lot of influence. And it was really flying under the radar. But Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries, excluding Qatar, sort of woke up to that reality right about the same time as the ISIS, as ISIS was making gains in Syria and Iraq. And there was an all-out war a little while back, and then you remember Qatar was declared a terrorist supporting state. Do you remember that? And the blockade and the isolation of Qatar, those two things kind of are part and parcel of one another, of Saudi Arabia stepping up attempts to reclaim Sana'a and reclaim stability, reclaim control of Yemen, for the south. So yeah, it's possible that this war on the Houthis is an attempt by the United States to woo Saudi Arabia back to their allegiance.
I mean,
It's possible.
they say, and I mean, this is kind of where lots of people are critiquing the US's actions, is that there was only one attack on a naval vessel in the Red Sea during the temporary ceasefire, and that Biden has been saying they want to, and I mean, Blinken as well, wanting to say that they want to find a diplomatic solution to what's happening in Gaza, and they want to de-escalate the situation, and this seems like it's an escalation rather than a de-escalation,
Escalation rather than de-escalation, for
and
sure.
they're avoiding a diplomatic solution. It just seems like hitting the Houthis right now is counterintuitive when they should be working towards a
Towards,
ceasefire, releasing the hostages.
yeah.
It's just, where do you see this going now?
I guess there's a couple of things that could happen. Sometimes in chess, you have to sacrifice your queen. So, as far as the country of Yemen itself goes, I think that Saudi influence in the beginning, in the short term, is a positive thing. And a unified country or a Saudi supported government will have human rights violations coming out its ears, but it will be stable and the economy will grow, and it will at the very least stop the absolute rock bottom for standard of living in the entire world next to North Korea.
Yeah.
So I
For
think
those of you
that
don't
on
know,
all
that Yemen is a disaster from a standard of living standpoint.
If you go to the Arabic speaking Middle East and mention the name Yemen to anyone, you will immediately get a reaction of fear, anxiety, and kind of astaghfirullah alazim, or something like that. It's widely known to be absolutely the deepest pit of human suffering in the world. And it has been since the event that I just described, which was when the Houthis took control of Sana'a. Before then, there was a two-front civil war, more or less, in Yemen. The Houthis in the north, they have a place called Sa'adah. And it's so isolated that when I was first wanting to go to Yemen, I tried to YouTube videos of drive-throughs of the city, which you can do for any city in the world. You can obviously YouTube, and someone will, with a 4K camera, drive through the city and show you all the nice places. And I couldn't find one. I found one video of a couple buildings, and that was it. I couldn't find any videos of any of the cities and communities in northern Yemen, in Sa'adah. So it's a really isolated part of Yemen, and it used to be just sort of, it was a war and they were fighting the south, but it was fairly contained to that part of northern Yemen. And then there was another war with the tribal armies in the south of Yemen that's kind of off and on again, between the government and the tribesmen in South Yemen, which are exert a lot of influence and are quite powerful. But then during the Barack Obama, Joe Biden regime, everyone remembers when Joe Biden was vice president, they really kicked off and started the concept of drone strikes. American drone strikes are really an Obama invention, for sure. So, and maybe that was just because the technology arrived on the scene during his presidency. But, and they're one of their main most important targets. They did a lot of work in Pakistan, but they did a lot of drone strikes in northern Yemen, and southern Yemen as well, because Al-Qaeda has a very close connection to Yemen. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is based in Yemen. Osama bin Laden himself is a Yemeni. He was born in Saudi Arabia, but his family's from Yemen. So Al-Qaeda has a strong support base in Yemen, and originally a lot of the what we used to call the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, or at the time called Afghanistan Arabs, came from Yemen. They fought in the so during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So the American drone strikes in Yemen possibly accelerated the fall of the capital city of Yemen to the Houthis, just because they provided a lot of credibility for Iranian propaganda and a lot of help with recruitment and advertising for the Houthis in Yemen, which Iran was able to exploit to heavily arm the Houthis, which they were then able to use to conquer the city, which I imagine came as a surprise to the Saudis. I imagine they kind of thought that the Houthis weren't a real big threat, and they could afford to sleep on this one. But as we've learned, it's actually really hard to destroy a non-state actor, a non-state entity. That's really hard to defeat those people. So what could happen is that the Houthis are weakened enough that the Saudi constituents in the south are able to reclaim the capital and gain some ground. I don't see them being destroyed or wiped out in this conflict at all. I see a negotiation between North and Southern Yemen. I don't know if I see a negotiation between Abdulmelek Houthi and the United States, or an envoy from the United States. And America does not have a track record for negotiating with those people. Israel does. They negotiate with Hamas, but America has never negotiated with the Taliban. They've never negotiated with Al-Qaeda at any moment, and they certainly never negotiated with ISIS. And it's with ISIS, the whole world was so against ISIS that the military action was successful, but it's not that way with the Houthis at all. So I don't know if destroying the Houthis is a successful prospect as much as it would probably ultimately in the long run make life better for Yemenis.
So maybe that's something I kind of want to ask you about. So, I mean, the world was very clearly united against ISIS, and obviously designated a terrorist organization. The Houthis also designated a terrorist organization from an extremist ideological point of view. How would the Houthis differ from ISIS in, say, like Islamic jurisprudence, their exegesis of the Quran and Hadith? Ideologically, what makes
Loads of
them
differences.
different, but
No.
still a terrorist organization?
I'll tell you this. There's no exegetical or theological difference between ISIS and the Houthis, save for what's normal between Shia and Sunni. What was going on with ISIS was that their leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, declared himself the Khalifa. So if you're familiar with Islamic eschatology, there's a couple of figures that should appear
Just
before
quickly,
the
eschatology
yeah
is the study of the last
oh yeah
days, if you're not familiar with your Greek theological
and the
terms.
study of what happens after you die, but in this context it's only the study of what happens at the end of time. Is that so the Islamic world during the life of the Prophet and shortly after was led by khulafa, led by khalifas, and after the first four successors of the Prophet, khalifa means successor. After the first four, lots of empires and countries claimed to be the Khalifa, but none of them wielded unequivocal status as the Khalifa since the death of Ali ibn Abu Talib. He was assassinated. So since the death of Ali ibn Abu Talib and the takeover and the takeover over of dynastic succession in Islam with the Umayyads, before then, the Islamic community would rally around and declare allegiance to a leader. It's called Mubayyah, and they would declare and elect a Khalifa, a successor of the Prophet, through a somewhat semi kind of democratic process, kind of sort of. And Islamic eschatology holds that before the arrival of the Mahdi and the Antichrist, the Dajjal, and the return of the Prophet Isa, alayhi salam, the Khalifa will return and Islam will be united under one leader again. So what happened with ISIS was that a gentleman claimed that status for himself. It's not the first time that's happened. And every time it's happened, it's been a complete disaster. The first time was actually more disastrous than this time, I think. But he declared himself a Khalifa in Iraq. And so ISIS means, everyone knows what ISIS means, yeah? Islamic State in Iraq in the Sham, or Islamic State in Iraq in the Levant. And so what he had claimed and what they claimed was that they were the locus of authority in Islam. They were the Khalifa, and it's the responsibility of the Khalifa in Islam to commit an offensive jihad so that the against the entire world until it all comes under the house of Islam. So modern Sunnism, for the most part, I would say, recognizes that defensive jihad is legitimate, and that's what Al-Qaeda claims to do. They claim to be on a defensive jihad against the United States because the United States is at war with the Islamic countries. I tell people all the time, there's really no key difference in interpretation or theology between Al-Qaeda and probably moderate Muslims, because both of them would agree that if Muslims are under attack, they have the right to defend themselves. The only question is, are Muslims actually under attack and do they need to defend themselves? Al-Qaeda answers yes. Most Muslims say no, at least not straightforwardly. But the Khalifa changes all that. He can declare open war against non-Muslim states and invade them and impose the rule of Islam on those states. And he can also demand the jizya tax from religious minorities. He can demand a tax from Jews and Christians. So what happened was, when ISIS first expanded and first had their offensive in the summer of that one year and conquered Raqqa and Mosul, they actually called for a meeting between the leaders of the Assyrian Orthodox Church and the Anglican Church and the other churches
Roman Catholic
all the churches that were in the territories that they had occupied. They called for a meeting with them to talk about how they were going to impose the Pact of Omar and Islamic law. That includes paying the jizya tax. It includes not being able to join the army. It includes riding sideways on a horse, not forward. It includes Christians wearing a big wooden cross, or sometimes they wore a special scarf, and Jews would wear a big wooden cow in reference to the second surah, second chapter of the Quran. So they started massacring Christians, but not before offering them the opportunity to come under traditional Islamic law as it relates to Christians and Jews, to dhimmis. So,
and they refused that. They refused that for
financial reasons. They didn't even meet with the leader.
Okay.
They didn't even meet with, and I don't think, given what ensued after, they had any confidence that any of this would go any other way. I don't think they trusted this leader that he wouldn't find an excuse to start committing massacres again. Or anyhow, they didn't meet with him. They were afraid of him for good reason. And then they started slaughtering Christians and beheading them and cutting them in half. They instituted something called what your right hand possesses, Malik Amin, which means that, and it's Islamic jurisprudence, well, when you conquer a country, you can take their women as wives, as sort of concubines. It means what your right hand possesses. And so they were taking from Christian families women that they liked and taking them as concubines, sex slaves, essentially, in accordance with Islamic law. So, yeah. So that horror.
We should also maybe evil, just say their specific interpretation of Islamic law.
Their interpretation of Islamic law.
Which is a minority position globally.
Yes, although not a minority position in terms of the classical Islamic scholarship on the matter or the sacred texts on the matter. So
controversial.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you want from me?
I want the truth.
Go out and buy a
muwatta. I want the truth.
Go to an Islamic bookstore and buy a muwatta from Imam Malik, and just read it. See what you get. So, Musnad Ahmed ibn Hanbal. So anyhow, yeah, they were following a lot of classical Islamic rules about what to do with the conquered people, and classical Islamic judgments about that. Whereas the Houthis haven't cast that much of a theocratic vision nearly that widely, and they certainly haven't claimed that status as an eschatological figure, you know what I mean? So their interests are primarily still, it seems, restricted to Yemen and maybe Israel. Of course, their threefold slogan is death to America, death to Israel, cursed be the Jews, victory to Islam. But you'll have noticed, if you hadn't already, that they've never participated in any conflict before now between Israel and Hamas. They've only ever concentrated their efforts on South Yemen and Saudi Arabia. So why the sudden interest in getting involved in matters that don't particularly relate to them? I think that it has to do with Iran initially threatening to go to war with Israel and then eventually telling Hamas, we just can't do that. We're sorry. And so I think that Iran, using its proxies, Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Houthis in northern Yemen, to contribute in what ways they can, and maybe help the people of Gaza, if by no other means than ballooning the conflict to a point where negotiations and settlements are finally come to until people, because on a normal day when you deal with a country as powerful as Israel and you're as feeble as Hamas, it's on you to create motivation for them to come to the negotiating table, because you suffer so many losses and they suffer so few that you want to come to the negotiating table much sooner than they do, and they don't really have the same compulsion or necessity of negotiating with you, and the conflict can go on and on and on. And they're comfortable and you're not. So you're always looking for ways of getting bargaining chips. And with Benjamin Netanyahu being so determined in this war to just destroy Hamas, whatever the cost, the necessity for increasing the bargaining chip has become higher than it's ever been before. So yeah, that could very well be what some people are thinking on the Iran and Hezbollah and Houthi side. Is we need to balloon this conflict so that it gets to a place where Netanyahu isn't totally in control of it, and it's not just up to him anymore, it's up to other people. And that will hopefully bring enough pressure to get the ceasefire to stop, or to happen, sorry, to get a lasting ceasefire to happen before they destroy too much, because they do not seem concerned about how much they will destroy if it means destroying Hamas. So, yeah.
Heartbreaking times.
Yeah. And there's something in the air. Maybe it's spiritual, but it's been a notice of mine for a long time that conflicts spiral out since COVID in ways they never did before. They just seem to, everyone is going to the most extreme reactions and opinions on every conflict that they can, way sooner and way more immediately than they ever did before. So every conflict that's developed since then, since COVID, has happened before in some way or another. Certainly Russia and Ukraine had their misgivings, and we all remember that. But it just never turned up to level 10 this quickly before. And the same with Israel and Hamas. They used to just trade pawns, I think. They used to just, Hamas would fire some rockets, Israel would drop some bombs, some people would die, and then Hamas would get some foreign aid money that they can embezzle, and Israel would get some propaganda points for the next election cycle, and everyone would win, shake hands, and go home. But something's different now. It's just different than it's been before.
Do you
Hitherto, yeah, go ahead.
I'm just wondering what are some of the factors that you think are playing into that? Because I think I would say two, maybe three. The first one would be that we're having for the first time just the instant spread of information. So people are seeing videos from Khan Yunis or in the West Bank from Nablus or Jenin. These, you know, they're seeing a live feed of people that's not put into a narrative by mainstream news outlets, and they can see something. So I think that there's an instant buy-in, especially from Gen Z. And I think that also economic pressure, precarity, I think that a negative outlook on where we're going economically, I think that people are feeling stressed, that they're nervous, that governments are feeling shaky. And I think that also governments have incurred a lot of debt coming out of the
Jeff, that's
pandemic.
true.
And I mean, this is maybe more of a conspiracy theory, but you know, war is good for business. And if
Can
governments,
be.
it's almost we naturally look for a scapegoat. That's more of a soft point, but the first two are definitely happening. People don't see a very bright future, and people are seeing information at a rate never seen before.
I don't know if I buy the first one. I think that what DeFrano described is real, but it happened 13 years ago. I think in 2010 was when people started seeing real images from around the world for the first time. And the social media, 2010 was, I don't think a whole lot of increase in availability, access, and information on social media has happened from 2010 until now. I mean, the volume has gotten more, but nothing radical or crazy has been invented. All the conflicts before, there have been lots of videos, and I think that the Syrian refugee crisis was a big staple moment for people seeing videos outside of narratives. You remember the big famous photos from that, the kid sitting in the chair covered in gray dust, and then of course the dead kid in Italy, I think,
I
on the
think it was,
beach,
yeah, Italy or Greece.
or Greece. Yeah, maybe it was Greece. So I think that the social media thing, definitely the pessimism for the future, 100%. COVID was apocalyptic in people's minds. Dare I say more than it was in reality? People really thought that the world was going to end in COVID. And everything that happened during that time, everyone annexed to it a super high apocalyptic level of significance. That this is the revolution that's going to end racism in America, right? Everyone was just having these really high-minded goals and these really extreme objectives, because for some reason, COVID made everyone think that they were right in the white hot light of history being made and everything being changed. I mean, airlines are exactly the same now they were before as they now as they were before COVID, for the most part, in just about every way. Flying is the same. No one wears masks. Security's just what it was. There's no medical tests. They were saying during COVID, flying's never going to be the same again. And when you fly again, you're going to need to prevent medical information and flu tests, and nothing like that at all. No simp If you're coughing in an airport, you're coughing in an airport. It's just the way it was before. But things did hit a weird watershed in history where everyone is now thinking that everything that happens is the most important thing that's ever happened. Definitely the pessimism. War is sometimes good for business, sometimes not. The war in Iraq was very expensive. The United States did not benefit economically from that. That was a heavy toll on them. But certainly on an individual level, the economic suffering is pretty widespread. And people don't have the cognitive space to evaluate things in a more reasonable and logical way in the way that they used to, because they're just so stressed out about life. So that's a big factor. I noticed, and this is probably irrelevant, that I get way more frustrated at video games since COVID started than I used to when I lose. You get upset. I used to never get that upset. But I think there probably are wider political reasons also. Two things. First of all, shortly after COVID, a precedent was set that if you want change in the world, you riot and you burn things and you massive protests, and that does work. So rather than waiting for change, you go out and you just do it with the first thing that comes to your mind to do. You burn down and tear down a statue, you set fire to a target, you burn the local police precinct. And it's not just a liberal thing. Definitely the anti-COVID protesters have their fair share of crazy rioting and burning and smashing and blockading. And maybe that mindset is carried over into every sort of facet of life, that the time is now. If you want to end this war with Hamas, just go and do it. If you want to kill Israel and hurt Israel, just go and do it. That could be a factor. And I've said this before, without taking a side in American politics, the current president does not convey strength when he talks. And he does not convey strength when he walks, and he does not convey vitality. And he lost Afghanistan before COVID, and it just happened. So, and he was just, oh, shoot. So, or no, it was during, sorry, it was after COVID, of course, but they lost Afghanistan, and that was
Well, they
just it.
definitely lost before, but they pulled out after. That had been long
Pulled out
gone
after,
lost.
right? Yeah.
That was lost
So,
even in the Trump era.
but I think it may not be too much speculation to say that if it were the Trump era, they might have gone back in.
To
They
Afghanistan.
might not have. They might not have. But Trump conveyed unpredictability, which has a value.
Yeah, I mean, what was it? What was that Soleimani? Was it Soleimani, the
Suleiman,
general that was assassinated with that drone strike? I think it was in Syria. Might have been Iraq.
It was in Syria. So he conveyed that at any minute he could be fire and brimstone about any issue. And you kind of got the sense that he didn't understand the wider picture of politics, but he responded to issues as they came up. And that conveyed to people a sense that you just didn't know what he was going to do when your issue came up. So you could invade the Ukraine when Trump is president, and he might send in American soldiers, boots on the ground, and declare war. He might not, but he might. And that sort of kept a lot of people in line, and that communicated a lot of strength that the current administration doesn't convey very, very well, especially losing Afghanistan and just and leaving a bunch of soldiers there and acting like it didn't matter or didn't happen. So I think a lot of people are maybe, and then the war in Ukraine also might have made a lot of other people think now is the time to strike when they're occupied and they're kind of with Ukraine and they're kind of weak-willed.
So then
So
where does that bring us now? Because I mean, the Houthis have been enduring conflict, famine, just general turmoil for almost a decade,
Yeah, for more than a
and
decade.
more than a decade. And I doubt that these few
Two decades is
airstrikes
upsetting.
have completely crippled them, and they have now said that the UK and the US are going to pay dearly for this. I can't remember the exact quote, but they issued a statement. What do their offensive capabilities look like, and how do you think that they oppose any threat to the US or the UK?
Everyone poses some kind of threat in the social media age because it's pretty easy to recruit terrorists from a distance. So from the perspective of military, of straightforward military conflict, no, I don't think they're going to come marching over the horizon.
Yeah, I don't think that's possible either.
What is very possible is that they could coordinate terrorist attacks with other people overseas. And this conflict is kind of filled with moral ambiguities. And a lot of the Western countries especially don't have the united sense of themselves and moral front that they used to have. In fact, they're very divided, with a lot of people thinking that Western countries only make the world worse, and a lot of people thinking they only make the world better. So there's a lot of opportunity to destabilize the Western countries from inside, and to recruit extremists from the inside that can then committed terrorist attacks on American soil. And the American public is very skeptical these days in ways they haven't been before. So even the people I listen to who are crazy anti-vax conspiracy theory folks don't believe the Israeli narrative about October 7th. So their skepticism does carry over to media that on the surface agrees with them, or what they would normally say in situations like these. So there's not a united push and a united will, let's say, on the American and British side for a war in Yemen that the Houthis can exploit with social media. What can happen is they can attack Saudi Arabia for sure, and they can continue to, they can make the Red Sea shipping a write-off and just impossible for a long time.
Yeah.
And that's real, and that hurts a little bit. What the United States and Britain can do is weaken them enough that the folks in Yemen, as I said, can take the reins, and Saudi Arabia can reclaim a lot of territory in Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
They can do that. And they can, yeah.
Sorry, go ahead. I don't want to cut you off.
Yeah. So they can coordinate. What the United States hasn't efficiently done is gotten rid of extremist groups, but they have been efficient at taking major population centers out of their control. So as a paramilitary group, guerrilla warfare is your primary means of fighting, and that relies on you being hard to find, quick in your attacks, and then disappear as soon as you were there. And so taking over Fallujah, for instance, was a brutal battle, but the United States conquered it. And taking over Mosul is a brutal battle, but the United States did it. What they couldn't do was get rid of the insurgency enough to keep the war in Iraq from becoming unprofitable and devastating to the American population's psyche, as soldiers die, suicide bombs, and things like that.
But that's the one thing I wanted to ask you is, it seems like to in this post-pandemic era that the climate has changed. And I'm wondering if you could help me put my finger on this. So in, for example, in the Iraq conflict, there seemed to be still at least at the early stages, some support, you know, the allegations of weapons of mass destruction, the US and the West in general are still reeling from the attacks on 9/11. There was a general sentiment that, you know, we got to go after these people, these terrorists, and even terrorist attacks in the 2010s in Europe. I'm thinking of that truck in Nice, shootings in Oslo, all different things, whatever.
What do they call the 7/7 bombings?
The
ones in England.
It seems now that something's changed in the water or in the air that, you know, we're seeing kind of. Like I was reading a report yesterday, and they were studying cases of anti-Semitism in adolescents in Germany. And what the researchers thought, because I mean, typically anti-Semitism has been correlated with right-wing ideologies.
Especially in Germany.
Which makes sense, right? Fascism, Nazis, it's on the right. But what the researchers found interesting was, and it should be noted that this is small pockets on the extreme of each ideology, but it was almost evenly distributed between left-wing ideology, extreme left, extreme right, and Islamic ideology.
Yes.
It was about the same on everyone. And the researchers, they thought, okay, that makes sense on the right. It makes sense in extreme
Islamic
interpretation of Islam. But the left was new for them. They thought, wow, that's interesting. And they pressed it to see, because there were subcategories in the survey.
Right.
Is this just anti-Israeli sentiments that are being confused with anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism? Yep. And it was not. that also the left believe these kind of tropes that Jews are trying to take over the world, these crazy anti-conspiracy theories. But the point, my point is in mentioning that is, and maybe this is migration to the West from the Islamic world, the growth of left ideology.
Yeah.
It just seems like there is a shift in the West to sympathize with these more extremist groups, these terrorist organizations, as they've been classified. So you see increasing left-wing ideology sympathizing with Hamas, with Hezbollah, with
don't forget the Osama bin Laden letter.
That I haven't heard about. So we'd like to.
I'll talk to about what that is when you turn the mic over to me.
And now we have the growing of the BRICS alliance, the shift away from a Western-dominated world order, and now in the IJ or ICJ, this court brought forward by South Africa, which is obviously also in the BRICS alliance. It just seems like, especially with this case in The Hague going on right now, that if, depending on the ruling, it just seems like we're the world is becoming increasingly polarized, kind of this the victim and the oppressor mentality, this kind of power dynamics that the Marxists love to point out. Just how do you see this kind of, like, I just feels like there's a major shift happening.
There is a major shift.
What do you have to say about that?
Yeah. So before I do want to bring up the Osama bin Laden letter, because I can't believe you hadn't heard of it. So I did a systematic functional analysis in my end of my first year of my master's degree. I did it in Arabic linguistics with a focus on pedagogy and on Osama bin Laden's letter, open letter to the United States in Arabic. And it became a very popular thing on TikTok. Like, I think they call it Bin Laden Talk. I think that's the word. Or is it Bin Laden Twitter? One of the two. It was either on X or on TikTok, where a bunch of young woke millennials were reading the Osama bin Laden letter and saying something like, 20 years after September 11th, and you realize that Osama bin Laden was right all along. They say that. And the obvious fact of the matter is that the woke critical theory lines up in some very important points with the classical Islamic view of the world. And it's used a lot of the same argumentation and talking points on university campuses for a very long time. I was speaking with a very woke university student when I was doing my master's research. I did it on students, study abroad students. And one of the guys who'd finished the program just exude femininity and lack of strength or manliness in every one of his mannerisms and characteristics. And he had a weird haircut that definitely made him stand out in Egypt. And just kind of a lanky, feminine looking, you could easily get that punch, push that guy into a locker and lock it and just move on, and it wouldn't take you that long, kind of a guy. And I was trying to give some people advice on where to go to learn Arabic in the Middle East. And someone brought up Mauritania. And I said, you want to be careful with Mauritania. It's a really tough country. And he got instantly offended that I would call a country tough. And his face turned really red. And he said, what do you mean a tough country? We're speaking.
And I said, well, Mauritania? Have you heard of slavery?
Well, let me finish my story. So I said, well, brace yourself, because you haven't heard this before, but I'm going to tell you now. The last country in the world to ban open slave trade was Mauritania in 2007. And they banned it on paper, but they don't let cameras into the country because there's still slave markets open on the street. And he got really offended at that and started pointing out that human trafficking exists in Western countries, and that sometimes human traffickers get at refugee camps in North Africa, and Westerners are responsible for that. Obviously, that is a pointless argument to make.
Yeah,
no true, one would think to say that.
Yeah, it's.
But why would it occur to you to try and defend a country with open slave trade? Because why wouldn't you just be horrified to learn that?
Yeah,
because it's part and parcel of the woke ideology to always try and point out the flaws in the West and make the West seem as bad as every other place. And it's part and parcel of them that Western moral superiority is also a form of colonialism and whiteness. And it's a very important doctrine of theirs, and you hear them say it all the time, that pointing out human rights violations in other countries as opposed to the United States is just hypocritical. And it's just an important part of wokeism. Wokeism is fundamentally anti-Western. It just is. That's what it is. It's Westernism is formed by colonialism and patriarchy, and Western dominance is, because if you understand the base of the theory, the base of the theory is that powerful people create culture so as to perpetuate the power imbalance between them and people without power. So they create culture, and that includes TV, movies, it includes jokes, comedy, it includes languages, what languages are used. All of that are purposeful designs of people with power to perpetuate their power. And since Western countries have had power, naturally and obviously, they're the villains, because ultimately, for critical theory, power imbalances need to be reduced. So it's fundamentally anti-Western, and any university campus you go to, there will be all kinds of, especially in the humanities, critiques of Western forms of this, Western forms of that, decolonizing this. And when they say decolonizing something, they mean, of course, this isn't novel, it needs to be less Western. It needs to be less white, which is the same as saying it needs to be less Western. And so that in and of itself isn't the only idea. To support that idea, you have to criticize the West on all kinds of other fronts, of course. Because classically construed, we say the civilized world, and classically construed, we think that the first world developed countries, the Western countries, are the best places to live. And we're normally vindicated by the volume of people trying to immigrate to those countries and the lack of volume of people trying to immigrate anywhere else. And in 2004, the most liberal people would have still agreed to most of that. They would have definitely said that there's lots of problems in Western countries that need to be fixed. They would definitely say that traditional Western culture is great, but it could include more diverse voices. But they would have agreed with most of what I just said about, yes, America's a great place to live and a lot of people want to come and live here. And if you don't believe me, just watch Parks and Recreation or one of the liberal shows that existed back then. And they bring up lots of liberal talking points, of course. But they all talk about America as if it's a great thing, essentially. But that changed with wokeism. And the more radically woke you get, the more critical of the West you get, because it's whiteness. And whiteness is the root of all evil in critical ideology. In critical ideology, it's an ideology of oppressors oppressing the oppressed. Now, BRICS are not oppressed. And the countries who make up BRICS don't think of themselves as oppressed. But going back to my story, if you're the sort of person who searches for reasons to criticize the West and say the West isn't so great, to try and balance things out a bit when you're criticizing a country like Mauritania, going to BRICS is kind of a, you know, it's there for you to go to. It's one of the things you can grab at to criticize Western culture and Western countries with. And of course, BRICS encourages these criticisms of the West. They're not woke, but woke is useful for them. And they do agree with lots of things that wokeness is about. And so does the Islamic worldview. The Islamic worldview has always had a lot in common with the woke worldview, in the sense that they've always seen Israel as a colonial occupation. And they've always seen that the powerful countries, the Western countries, use their military to increase their economy, and use that to keep supporting Israel. It has always been a way of explaining why the Islamic countries fail and the non-Islamic countries succeed if Islam is supposed to be the truth. So there's overlap on all these ideologies. And for people who don't think particularly deeply, which is everyone, when you find those surface level agreements, you start to, you know what I mean, grasp on and go down these certain roads. So yeah, there's a Scottish member of Parliament, I think in Britain, called George Galloway. I used to listen to him a lot when I was younger. And he says a lot about how Iran is right and America is wrong, and Hezbollah is right and Israel is wrong. And that was really popular for a while. But he's not. He's Muslim. He's woke. Could never be a Muslim. But Muslims are an oppressed class in the woke framework. So yeah, they find these paramilitary organizations kind of rebellious, and being a rebel is very chic in critical theory. So yeah, that's kind of yeah. It
So
should also be mentioned. I've talked too long, it doesn't have to be
no, go
mentioned.
for it. I'm curious. I got
In
another question.
2004 was different also because the political lines themselves were also very different. And the religious right had a lot more, I would say, solidarity and unity as a movement. And for a lot of us young conservative Christians, that was actually a watershed moment where a lot of us wandered away from conservatism and even Christianity for a long time because we voted in George W. Bush for the classical conservative Christian reasons, the same-sex marriage and abortion. And he did his best on both those fronts. Then he went to war in Iraq, and the question became, are we going to stick to our guns or are we not going to? I don't think a lot of people in the conservative Christian camp were actually convinced that there was weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. What they were convinced of is that a man of God was in charge who prays a lot, and so God will take care of us, and he's our guy. And so they defended it and stuck to it based on allegiance. And lastly, this is where your first point becomes really, I think, significant and important, is that in 2004 there wasn't really social media or the internet, so you just had to believe what the news said, and it made it much easier for governments like George W. Bush's administration to make things seem more convincing than they actually were as it related to weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Whereas with the internet now, we probably would have torn that apart pretty quickly.
It's so
Yeah,
true.
anyhow.
Oh, so then just last question that we can close. I don't know how long we've been talking, but
Almost an hour.
oh, that's actually good timing then. I'm wondering, so then especially in light of the suffering in Yemen, the suffering in Gaza and the West Bank and the Negev. I don't want to discount there's a lot, and also anti-Semitism is shooting through the roof in Europe and North America. I don't want to forget Jewish friends that are suffering, but the point is that there is a lot of suffering.
Suffering, yes.
And as Christians, the greatest command, love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. What's the Christian's move now?
So, well, first of all, it's to pray, for sure, for everybody. The Zionist Christian camp talk about loving and praying for Israel. I do think that there is a real, I would say, not a revival, but a growing movement of Christians remembering to pray for Palestine as well in light of this conflict, more so than there's ever been before. If this happened in 2004, it would be all pray for Israel all the time and no one would ever. But now, I think Christians are remembering to pray for Palestine and Palestinians. And then maybe going back to the early church, taking care of the children who are left in the street. Because of the Roman cultic practices and because of how the Romans viewed things. Everyone knows the story that the Christians were taking in all of the streets, all the children who've been abandoned in the streets in Rome in front of temples and things like that. And that was a big factor in the spread of Christianity. So I think you can be a light and a witness without being politically involved is probably the best thing to do.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Pethwell Project. If you like what you heard, feel free to give us a rating, or even better, share this with one of your friends. For more information, check out our website at pethwellproject.com or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Pethwell Project.